Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt. Welcome to this very special spoiler podcast dedicated to Marvel and Netflix's Daredevil, their 13-episode series about the origins of the blind superhero Matt Murdock. Joining me to discuss the ups and downs and ins and outs of the show are Helen O'Hara.
Hello.
Phil Dissemblian.
Hello.
Ali Plum.
Hello.
And Matt Murdock. No, he's not here. He's a fictional character. However, we do have Charlie Cox, the British actor who plays Matt Murdock in the show. He came into London last week to talk about stuff. He lives here, but he just dropped in anyway. And we asked him about spoilerific stuff. So here, first of all, before we begin, is Charlie Cox talking about some of the really spoilerific stuff that happens towards the end of the Daredevil series. Again, I will say, as we always do with all the spoiler specials, if you haven't seen Daredevil, if you haven't seen all 13 episodes, don't listen to this podcast until you have. Don't listen to the interview until you have. Go away, watch them, and then come back. Okay? Done? Sorted? Here's Charlie Cox. Enjoy.
Let's talk about that corridor fight scene.
Yeah.
Which is like Old Boy meets Raid meets all your wildest cinematic fantasies. Yeah. Well, was that fun? How long did that take to shoot?
That was a really, really cool moment. But I remember reading it in the script and thinking, like, having to reread it and think, how... Okay, the door open, you know, because they've described it all and you can't try and imagine. And it says very specifically in bold, you know, this following sequence happens in one take. So we spent the first part of the morning, it's the end of episode two. So we've, you know, as a crew and a cast, we're getting to know each other, but it's still been, you know, very, it's frantic and early days and we haven't bonded per se yet. And we spent the whole first half of the day, the morning, just rehearsing the camera moves. Just making sure they were right. And then we got into it. And, you know, the first two or three takes, we didn't get past the first minute. And then we started getting deeper and deeper into it. And then we got early on, about take five or six, we got a usable take. We got all the way through and it was quite good. It wasn't perfect. And the question was, do we continue and try and get another one? And we did. And we didn't get another one until, I think we finally got it again in take 11 or 12. So take 12, it was 12 takes. And it was such, and it was now midnight. You know, we've been there for 15, 16 hours. Chris Brewster, who did the majority of that stunt work, was absolutely knackered. He'd taken a hit to the head at one point as well, so he was operating on some other level. And we all gathered around to watch it. Was it as good as we remembered? And it was this huge cheer and bonding moment. And it's, you know, it's, as you say, it's an homage to a great film, to great fight sequences like the Old Boy in the Raid and stuff like that.
So. It's a real statement of confidence in the show, I think. It's the moment when, as a viewer, you're like, they really believe in what they're doing, and you can go with that, because the camera stays fixed on empty space, which is breaks a bit of a rule, doesn't it?
Yeah,
the characters go off frame into rooms, have fights that you're not privy to, and I just wonder what's going on in those rooms when people are thrown in. Are you just standing there going, okay, what a wait?
Well, so I go into a room initially, right? So I walk down the corridor, and before the fight actually kicks off, I go into a room, the camera pans, I have three or four fight moves to get through, the door slams shut, then we all had to clear because the door blows itself off the wall. Oh. Someone comes through in it. So, and I had to run, I had to get off the set. It's like doing a play. I had to run off the set. I had to run around to another entrance because the next time I come in is from the other door. And so when I go into that room, the door shuts and then Chris Brewster comes out and does the majority of it. And then I come out and I do a little bit from another room and then run back round. It was a huge operation.
That's, I would love to have been on set with that one.
Yeah,
the other big fight, obviously, is the fight with Kingpin.
Yeah. Well, there's a big one in 9 as well.
Well, that's true. Yeah. That is true. I'm not denying that, but I just want to ask you whether it was you or Chris Brewster who gets lifted up into the air and then just dropped like a bag of bricks onto the floor.
Wait, so remind, which bit are you talking
final
about?
Final episode. You're in the alleyway.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. So when he, like, the Superman kind
exactly,
of thing.
Exactly,
yeah. Yeah, we both did it. So we both did it. They had to get like a wire crane situation. I had to wear a harness for that bit. We both did it. And what they do is they drop you and then you stop just below the ground.
Mission Impossible style.
Yeah, yeah. And then exactly. And then you pick up the last moment.
Wow.
But, you know, and part of this show, one of the things people seem to be responding to is the fact that this superhero takes a real beating in many of the episodes. And what I've discovered from having to film those is it really, you take a beating when you lose fights on television and film because you spend certain amount of my neck. The amount of times I had to throw my neck back, like, you know, like because I've just been punched or throw myself on the ground because of, you know, my knees and neck took a real, you know.
I suppose it's the next day when you wake up, you're like, I'm still battered from the, I have to do it again.
I'm still battered from the fight in which I didn't actually connect with any punches.
The fight with Nobu is remarkable. And that's the closest, I think, that Matt comes to the end. How close do you think he is?
You know, I think we really wanted to really you know, look over the precipice of that possibility. I think, you know, it's one of the problems I have with one of the few things I have with superhero films and television shows occasionally is that I find it difficult when there's an ambiguity about whether someone can die or not, or if I feel like they can't in any way. The stakes just naturally lowered, and you're less invested. So I think they were really interested to feel like to ram home this point of this how fallible he is and how vulnerable he is. You know, he doesn't have unbreakable skin or super strength or anything like that. And hopefully, when you watch the show, you will feel like he really comes close to perishing. Just going back for a second to that scene you talked about in two, one of the things I think that works so wonderfully in that is how there are moments where all, even the bad guys and Daredevil are having to catch their breath. They can't carry on. It's like a boxing match, you know, and you don't often get to see that. And I think people really enjoy that because they relate. That's what it's like when you, if you ever see an actual fight on the news or on television or whatever, or if you're involved in one,
yeah,
God forbid, you, that's what it's like, you know.
Well, there's this word gritty, which seems to be becoming sort of almost a cliche for the superhero, the post Christopher Nolan superhero world,
right?
And the worlds are often gritty, but the fights aren't necessarily in the same way. Whereas yours are properly gritty.
Yeah.
And the fight with Nobi, it reminded me of like some of those old shark books where you see the victims of shark attacks. He's like basically disemboweling you.
Yeah,
that was the
moment that you're talking about where he gets me with that.
But you got better.
Yes, he gets through it, but it takes an entire episode to get through it, you know.
And not many shows would allow that to happen. I think Netflix is rare that he can say, right, this episode, next one, is obviously recuperation. He can't just get up and go, right, which bad guy shall I punch next?
Yeah. And also, you know, being on the next platform, Marvel are allowed to, you know, include blood, and boy, did they go.
Yes, they did.
Did they enjoy
that? I was
going to
ask you, were you on set for the Vinnie Jones Lock, Stock style car door head smash?
I was turned up at the very end of it. I went to go and see it, and because at that point I hadn't worked with Vincent, I'd met him, but it was one of his first days on the set, so I went to go and meet him and kind of regretted it, actually. It was a pretty chilling moment, actually. But it's wonderful writing, isn't it? So, you know, you've met him for an entire episode, and all you've seen is him falling in love, you know, the bad guy, and then that happens, you know.
Yeah, it is a lovely sort of reversal of what you're expecting. Yeah. Matt, as a lawyer, you see him in action lawyering at various times, but you really only see him in court on the one occasion
in episode three
where he gives his kind of this is what I stand for moment.
Yeah.
Reminding me a lot of sort of The Verdict or 12 Angry Men, all those kind of like, you know, especially the sort of Sidney Lumet type films.
Yeah.
How did you talk about that?
Well, I rewatched, you know, when I read that speech that he gives, I rewatched JFK and also Streets of Philadelphia. There are wonderful closing arguments in both those films. And To Kill a Mockingbird and ones like that. But I was really excited about that. And I think if there's one request I would have for the second season is that we'd see more of him as a lawyer.
Yeah.
One of my favourite series in the comics is when in the Bendis Maliev series where Matt Murdock defends the White Tiger. And it's such an interesting kind of dynamic because he's defending, you know, as Matt Murdock, and people don't know he's Daredevil, he's defending a superhero. And so he's talking about the White Tiger, but he's also talking about himself, you know, and that's a very cool cinematic moment that I'd hope we get to incorporate in further seasons. But it was very important to find that side of Matt Murdock, and I think the reason it was so important is because I think we really have to believe that Matt Murdock 100% believes in the law, he believes in order, he believes in the justice system, and he thinks that is absolutely the right path. He believes passionately in it. So therefore, when he does put on this mask and go out at night and take the law into his own hands, we question that, and as we see that conflict, and we have a hero that we're not convinced is on the right path all the time, you know, making the right decisions.
It's a difficult question to answer in some ways, but we're expecting that Wilson Fisk cannot be held back by bars and the judicial system for very long because he seems to own everything.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering from Matt Murdock's point of view, how jaded is he going to become, do you think, seeing that the society isn't really doing its job properly and can't really control these people? Well, let's not talk about season two, but maybe from now, at the end of season one, when he's seeing, he's presumably going to see the fallout of what's happened.
Yeah.
He's probably not got much faith in message.
Yeah, he takes it pretty badly, but I think he also, I think my feeling is that Matt Murdock is he understands how people operate. He just happens to believe in the better side of community and the better side of human beings. And I think this is discussed quite a lot in the last few episodes of the first season. He believes in people's ability to rise above and make the better decision, but sometimes they need a helping hand. But I think he can also then go home and take it all quite personally and find it quite painful. And that's great because from a character's point of view, it just makes him so much more layered and interesting, you know. That answers the question.
Yes, it does.
I want to ask a probably equally general question here, but obviously Netflix doesn't come out on DVD, not for a while yet, but what deleted scenes can you think of? Things that you shot that you were like, oh, that was really interesting, but didn't actually make it into the show. Anything that you'd like to mention?
Do you know what? At this point, I haven't even finished the entire season yet.
You're kidding me.
Yeah, so I've been going around doing...
Well, it's really good.
Thank you so much. Yeah,
you'll enjoy it.
So I don't know, but from the ones I've seen, I think I've seen up to including six. There is nothing that I can think of that hasn't made... I mean, there's lines here and there that have been taken out, and maybe there's a couple of... structurally, they've changed the order of things, but it's pretty much the writing was so strong. I've been on a couple of television shows, and one of the things that's quite common is you get rewrites right up until the day before you shoot a scene. There's rewrites, pink pages, green pages, yellow pages, and we had so few of them. They were so confident. There was the scripts were written, and they came in, and they were so strong that they'd be issued and a couple of weeks before the episode or a week before the episode, and then they'd stay that way, other than a few minor typos. So based on that, I suspect that they were well thought out enough and well structured that in the edit they worked, you know.
You wouldn't mind asking one last question. Have you met Stan Lee? How are you going to incorporate him into the universe? I saw that his picture is as an old policeman that you see on the wall.
Episode 5 or something.
Please tell me that somehow he rocks up. Tell me there were discussions.
I have not met Stan Lee.
No!
At this point, and I really hope to. I do have a Marvel Encyclopedia signed by him, which is on eBay at the moment. I'm kidding. No, so I was hoping I'd get to meet him at the premiere, but he wasn't, because it was in Los Angeles, but he wasn't there. I don't know. I guess now if he does show up in the show, it will have to be as a policeman.
Has to.
Who knows? It'll be great. Here we go. I hope he does. I hope he's seen it and he loves it. I'm sure he does.
Charlie, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
A lot of fun. Thank you.
That was great. Thank you, guys.
We're recording this on Thursday. You listened to this not on Thursday, obviously, but I finished the final two episodes last night, and I left a couple of days just because I've been so busy recently, and I left a couple of days between watching all the previous episodes, like fairly binge watching up until 12 and 13, then took a couple of days off, and then I watched 12 and 13 on their own last night, and I kind of wonder if that was a mistake, in that especially the last episode for me doesn't stick the landing, and I don't want this to turn into a kind of it wasn't all it could be, but the fact of the matter is, for me, up until about episode 10 or 11, this is a really, really good show. I really enjoyed it. I was watching it with my wife. She turned to me at one point and said, I think I'm enjoying this more than I have enjoyed anything that Marvel have done so far.
Wow.
I don't necessarily agree with that.
What did you
in fact,
do?
I don't agree with that.
You only watched Iron Man 2 over and over for the past few years.
I quoted chapter and verse. I went, how dare you, Guardians of the Galaxy and Avengers and whatnot.
Did you go full Mandarin on her?
I did. I went, ladies and gentlemen... But then I watched the last two episodes in isolation, and they're not as good, I don't think. But I don't want to start with negatives. I want to start with positives, and there's a lot to praise about this show.
Why do people like it so much? I think of the group, I like it a lot. I do think it's great. But you tell me, what makes it so good? In your own words.
Who wants to start?
It's probably known that I'm not as versed in the superhero world as you guys. I enjoy it very much.
You openly sneer at it. You have nothing but contempt for it.
That's unfair.
I know. I'm pigeonholing.
As long as he can watch it in Swedish.
A pigeonhole sat on a branch, reflecting on existence. Phil, I'm only kidding. Phil, come back to us.
Wait, I'm back. I didn't enjoy that very much, but I'm back. No, I do. Regardless of what you've just said, I do enjoy superhero stuff, and I really enjoyed this. The gritty, regrounded Christopher Nolan, post-Christopher Nolan superhero world has become a bit of a trope, and especially in some of the DC iterations, I would say the fun seems to have drained out of it, like water swirling down a Hell's Kitchen gutter. This has an element of that grit. We talked about it with Charlie Cox in the interview. The action sequences have that fierceness, that ferocity, and yes. they feel much more real. And they you can feel the stakes, and these people are getting, you know, he's getting properly wounded and taken close to the edge. And I like that about it. I also like that it sort of it seems to take the 70s cinema as its inspiration. The films that I really love by Sidney Lumet and William Friedkin, French Connection, I know, was a touch point. You know, The Verdict on the one hand, Dog Day Afternoon, those sorts of movies. They're fantastic films, a glorious time in cinema. And it's great to see that kind of living again on the small screen in this. I thought it was also just gripping, really. I really, just really enjoyed it, and it's really well played. I thought the acting was fantastic.
Yeah.
Charlie Cox is really good. Vincent D'Onofrio, just fantastic. This is what Helen and I were.
Yeah, I'm gonna rave about him in a minute.
You can go right ahead, rave now.
Honestly, I loved D'Onofrio's Wilson Fisk / Kingpin to an extent that almost completely unbalanced the show. Like, I think it's, I don't remember which episode number, it was about 11-ish, where Daredevil is about to out him, maybe a little bit earlier than that. And I was genuinely mortified on his behalf that he would be suddenly dragged into the spotlight. I'm like, oh my goodness, this poor guy, all he's worked for will be destroyed.
This poor guy.
He's the bad guy. He's the bad guy. And I know he's the bad guy, but I was still just, I had so much empathy for him and so much sympathy for him that it almost just unbalanced things. Not that I didn't love Charlie Cox's Matt Murdock as well. I think he does a really good job. But D'Onofrio just gets so much hurt and so much pain into even his most kind of most despicable moments that it almost kind of makes you root for the bad guy. You can genuinely, there's that one episode where it flashes back to him as a 12-year-old, and you can see the same scared little fat kid in D'Onofrio's eyes a few minutes later that you on screen. I mean, that's absolutely incredible stuff.
He's absolutely fantastic, and that is absolutely a legacy of the longer format.
Yeah.
Simple as that. It allows you more time to give depth and shade to all the characters, pretty much. And he is the biggest beneficiary of that for me. He's astonishing in this role. He is Wilson Fisk, who, to my ears, and I may be wrong on this, is never referred to as a kingpin at any point in the show.
No.
Daredevil obviously gets called Daredevil right at the end.
Yeah.
He doesn't get called the kingpin. I thought there might be even a scene at the end where he goes, I am no longer Wilson Fisk, I am the kingpin of crime. But no, nothing like that. He's great. He's really good. He's such a good actor, D'Onofrio, and he has been brilliant for so many years and so many things. Law and Order, Criminal Intent, most notably, I think, and Full Metal Jacket. But he's so good in this, and I'm really glad that he's sticking around. He gives real three dimensions to a character that could have been absolutely just a caricature. And you're right. Your loyalties are split slightly.
They are, I think that is one. I think my main caveat, I guess, in my general praise and general love for the show, I think the one thing that I think it fails to do is make it clear quite how bad the Kingpin's plans are for Hell's Kitchen. Yeah. Obviously, he does bad things in pursuit of those aims, but we don't know. The aims just seem to be what, general gentrification, like moving poor people out to move rich people in coffee shops. This is bad. I understand that, and you know, I'm a wishy-washy liberal, so I really do have a lot of sympathy with that being a bad aim. But at the same time, it's not specified really why he's any worse than any businessman, because they're all trying to do that and they've done it to the rest of Manhattan already. So I think that there's a little bit of a failing to make it clear how bad his actual aim is, because let's face it, his methods are not that different from Daredevil, and that's something that the show does bring out quite well.
What is a liberal, sorry?
Donald Trump has never meloned a man's head with his car door, though, in fairness.
That we know of.
That we know of. I don't think he'd need to get someone to do it for him. I don't think that's his thing. Toupee would come off.
I would say, as well as the Sidney Lumet references, I felt there was a bit of like Mark Steven Johnson to this.
Yeah, I want to before we get into the show, really defend the Mark Steven Johnson movie. Because it's getting a lot of flack.
And do you know what? I felt sorry for it, so I went back and watched it after watching the show.
The extended edition.
Actually, no, I didn't have that to hand.
Director's Cut's
which
better.
I know it's much better, but the theatrical really released edition, I mean, I remember really liking it at the time, apart from anything else, for Bullseye, who I think is brilliant.
Yeah.
But it really suffers by comparison, like a lot. And that's because the action scenes, I mean, obviously the effect of age, that's nobody's fault. Mm. That just happens. So the action scenes suffer because of that. But you've also got really just tonally odd moments, like the fight with Elektra in the playground. It starts off in a really cute way on a really cute small scale. Mm. By the end of that fight, there is no way anyone watching would believe that man is blind. Like, no way in heck or in Hell's Kitchen that anybody believes that man is blind by the end of that fight, because he does clearly impossible things, and he does them in open broad daylight.
For me, it did a lot of things right. Mm. And in a weird way, it got things right that Daredevil didn't in the end. I prefer the costume, weirdly enough, of the 2003 movie to the
final hero
costume of this one. I kind of preferred the black mask and the guy running around in a polo neck.
Yeah, he looked good there.
I preferred that a little bit. Bullseye is a great villain, but obviously it doesn't have the depth of the TV show. But it gets a bit of an unfair kicking, and the director's cut is very good. But this, which is not to say it's a masterpiece, it isn't. I'm just saying it's better than its reputation.
Fair enough.
Going back to Fisk, just briefly, yeah. What I really enjoyed about the show is that every single kind of character dynamic between one character and another has something going on in it. Mm. Really interesting things, and the sands keep shifting. Again, it's something that, you know, you can only do on the long form, perhaps. But for instance, Leland Owsley, the Bob Gunton character, his dynamic, his relationship with Fisk is fascinating to me. I'm like, what is going on there? Because this is a man who he knows the guy's dangerous, physically dangerous and lethal and ruthless, and he shows him no respect in front of his coterie of fellow villains. And yet, you know, what? Obviously Fisk needs him. Mm-hmm. They need each other. It's kind of, it's parasitic, it's symbiotic. There's lots of stuff going on. And that's just one of the two kind of characters. The relationship between Vanessa and Fisk is really interesting. We were talking about that on WhatsApp as well. And, you know, even the Foggy and Karen Page relationship shifts a lot in the period of time, and that's a subsidiary consideration at times, but really interesting. So just really good writing, and the pacing I think worked well too. There's very physical fighty episodes, and then, you know, as Charlie Cox said, he has to recuperate, he can't fight because he's not that kind of superhero. So it slows down, so it worked for that.
And even in the fight scenes you see that. I mean, the one that everyone's been raving particularly about is the corridor fight. Obviously in episode 2, I think that was.
It is episode 2.
And he's not moving from punch to punch in that. He's reeling from punch to punch. Like, you feel that this is a guy who's just taking a beating, and he's still giving one out, and he's still staying up. But there is, you know, it doesn't look super heroic. It just looks heroic. And that's just a brilliant, brilliant piece of filmmaking, TV making, that deserves all the press it's getting. And I think that's one of those elements that makes this feel much less shiny and polished and as you've said, grittier than the likes of Arrow and Flash and so on that are on other channels at the moment. This one feels a little bit less less artificial in that way.
I would say that sometimes I felt like they took 3 episodes to do what could be done in 2. Not that that's necessarily a good or bad thing, but I found at times it wasn't to my taste. I also felt at the beginning, again, we had lots of text conversations at the beginning about this, but I personally found that Eldon Henson's take on Foggy wasn't quite what necessarily I was expecting, but what I wanted. I liked what he was doing. His purpose was served. Mm. He's not just comic relief. He's more than that. He's more than just a sidekick. I appreciate that. I just didn't necessarily buy him. I didn't really feel like I was connecting with him. And yet by the end, when you do get the kind of avocados at law, I like that. I was more into it then. He takes a little bit longer for me to get into. I also felt that at times, you talk about the Dark Knight thing, that it did feel like the voice in particular was very, "Where is he?" And
he does actually say, "Where is he?"
Yeah.
At one point in a growly voice.
So there were times when I felt it lent a little, as you say, too much from the Dark Knight, but by and large, an emphasis on the large here, this really was enjoyable and was very good. But at the same time, I feel like it's one of those first series that will set up for a much more confident, strong, impactful, structured, maybe a bit zippier for me, second season.
Yeah, I kind of felt that maybe the pacing was a little bit off sometimes. There was one episode, actually I think it's probably pretty much my favourite episode, weirdly enough, which is Nelson v. Murdoch, which is about the fallout after Foggy finds out that Matt is Daredevil, which is something that didn't happen in the comics for years and years and years. So it was really interesting they brought it forward. In fact, there was some major deviations from comic book lore. Mm. Ben Urich, for example, does not die in the comics. And that was a big one. But it was one of my favorite episodes. But there were two scenes that ran off from each other. One which was Karen talking to, I think it was Karen talking to Matt, trying to convince him to do something to go on with the investigation of Fisk, and he was basically saying, it was either him or Foggy, but saying, deal with it, Karen, let's move on, real world, this is not going to happen, he's too big to take down. And then she goes and talks to Ben Urich and has exactly the same conversation in the very next scene. And you just want, if you trimmed 10 minutes out of each episode and maybe lost one or two episodes, but we'd have had a belting.
Wasn't that making her desperate enough to do what she then does?
Yeah, that's also bad screenwriting, because she was saying exactly the same things. Exactly the same things in the very next scene.
That's not unfair, I would say. But I guess it's the symptom of the difference in binge watching. If you watch this in the old style, where you have an episode a week, you'd get a week of being pasted for that sort of thing, wouldn't you? You'd get a week where everyone had seen it and they were like, oh, that was a bad episode.
Yeah.
What the heck?
Yeah.
Nothing really happened.
That's so
they
true.
Were repeating dialogue. Now you watch it and you watch the next one within 5 minutes and it's in the past.
Gone. It's gone.
So for me, watching it in probably like with Helen, watching it in the space of 2 or 3 days.
Yeah.
You just don't really mind that stuff because it's gone.
And in a way, because
you're watching it in such large chunks, like films,
yeah.
you don't mind the fact that it slows for 60 minutes. But whereas if you watch it in isolation, you'd be like, bloody hell, that was dull.
And it rewards binge watching rewards things and with that attention to detail. For example, the priest who shows up in episode 2 and doesn't appear again until episode 8 or 9.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But when he reappears again, he says, oh, let's have that latte that he mentioned in a throwaway line in episode 2. Now, if you were watching this 7 weeks apart, you'd be going, who's this guy and what latte is he talking about? But when you're watching 10 hours apart, you kind of go, oh, right, I get
thanks
that.
Thanks a latte.
That's,
yeah. Yeah. In a you'd have to go, do you remember that conversation we had about the latte and you didn't want one? How about we have it now?
Previously on latte. But there was stuff about this show I really, really loved. I loved the fact that it was shot in New York. That just felt so integral to me. It felt so important. It felt like Law and Order superheroes to me in many ways.
Yeah, there is that procedural aspect. I also love the fact that the way that they explained why Hell's Kitchen could possibly, not already be gentrified, have a crime problem. Oh, it's because of Avengers, which is great. The idea that that part of New York took the biggest hit, and that's why it's being redeveloped, and that's why there's all this kind of corruption and this money flowing in, because suddenly you've got 10 solid blocks of Manhattan that you get to rebuild.
Yeah, we're coming on to the Easter eggs stuff, that was the first one, wasn't it? But I just wanted to say that, talking about the location of shooting in New York, there is that part of New York that you think of New York as a high-rise city, and it is. But when you go and stay there in a hotel, you'll be on like the 10th floor, and it is the water coolers and the rooftops, and it has this other world that, you're either on the ground or you're up in the sky. But actually, a lot of it's sort of 10 stories up and throwing people off buildings and into skips, and he's running along the rooftops at night. I just thought that was kind of an interesting setting for a lot of this stuff.
Mm.
Do you think he ever went to pick up his white stick that he threw in that bin when he runs along to the heroin?
He goes
plant?
Through a lot of white sticks in this. Like he loses them left, right, and centre.
It's just like, who is he?
If someone had moved that bin in between the time he fell in it and the time he pushed someone off, knowing it was below, and like, I thought I'm going, just going to move that 5 yards down the street.
Yeah, but he's using his senses. He knows the bin is there.
His flame vision.
How does he know I didn't get that. How does he know the bin is there?
Well, the way they explained it in this is that he radiates outwards, his senses radiate outwards, and so, but that's just the way it was presented.
It's not just sound, it's also smell and
How radars for sound?
Yes.
He's incredibly smelly, and so that stink radiates off things. Bins are very easy because they smell a lot themselves, so that's
so
a real easy one. Yeah, it's phonar.
Phonar, okay.
I also like the fact that clearly only had enough money in the budget to do it once. They showed it once with Rosario Dawson. We're done now, guys. Mm-hmm. Whereas in the MSJ version, it's like
all over
every
the place.
5 minutes, here's the radar.
And suppose they did it really well in that version.
They did,
So that's one of the things that I think they probably intentionally chose not to do.
It's a tricky thing to do. It's like that they did it so well, it's like you don't want to just do that again. But maybe in season 2 they'll do more of that stuff.
You don't see the flame when he's doing the super lawyering.
he should be doing many, many more cases, because how can he lose? Mm. He knows when they're lying. Mm. The very second when they change their mind, he knows the pressure point. Mm. I want to see a season which is a spinner from this, which is just him, you know, divorce courts, you know, parking spaces, just making sure shit gets done.
Could become a new Matlock.
Better call Matt.
Yes.
You know. Matlock, right?
Yeah, better call Matlock. Yeah, absolutely. But there's only one episode in which you actually see him in the courtroom, episode 3. Yeah. And I just wanted more of that
stuff. Well, he talked about it in the interview, as we've heard, and he wants it too. So I did too. I thought those scenes were really good. That scene was good.
Because all the way through, Foggy and Matt keep referring to the fact that they have no clients. And that's fine, but after a while you're kind of going, yeah, you actually don't have any clients. How are you keeping the practice alive? Then again, the big check from Wilson Fisk cleared, and I guess they kept him in money for a little while. But there's a lot about the show I really, really loved. I loved pretty much all the characters, again, because of the depth, including people like Wesley. Toby Leonard Moore in that role was fantastic. He was completely inscrutable, to the point where in his final episode, you weren't sure if he was the one who was selling out Fisk.
No, true. Yeah.
So when he goes to meet Karen, you're not entirely sure what the play is. And I was genuinely shocked that he died at that point. It didn't seem entirely in character that he would be so lax as to leave a gun within reaching distance of someone. But, you know, even when she pumped 6 bullets into him, I thought, he's pretending.
I did as well, he's going to rip off his... it's a bit Scooby-Doo.
And then you get that lovely moment with Fisk, sort of sitting holding his hand.
Yes.
Which
kissing
again,
him, giving him a goodbye kiss.
Yeah, which again is just an extra little dimension to the man. Because, you know, he shouted at him sometimes. He was pretty tough with him sometimes. But at the same time, there wasn't just a reliance there. There was some kind of almost relationship. And I thought that was really nice. And you mentioned the Easter eggs. I mean, there are lots of little Easter eggs. Dating a Greek girl in college.
I missed her.
Chief among them, yeah.
Really?
Took Spanish to impress a Greek girl. So.
She's Electra's got to be in season 2, hasn't she? She's got to be.
Which would be good, because one of the other major problems a lot of the kind of websites I read have identified is the complete lack of women behind the camera, behind the scenes. There was one screenwriter for one episode, I think. And you know, the ones in front of the camera, you know, are a secretary, a nurse, and an art gallery person,
and a
lawyer,
and unspeakably evil crime lord
who may be Asgardian or something.
Yeah, she seems to indicate that, you know, yeah, that does seem weird. She speaks all languages, and she can do. She has some sort of power that she displays to Matt. There are little moments, little hints, and I think this may tie into Iron Fist's show more than, say, aka Jessica Jones or Luke Cage.
His nemesis's symbol is on the heroine as well.
Yeah, it is true. And but there's like that stick episode, yes, which ends with someone talking about
the weapon.
The
stick talking to stone.
Black Sky weapon.
Maybe Black Sky will be Iron Fist's nemesis.
Yeah, and I think that sort of mysticism, which is obviously coming to the Marvel Universe with Doctor Strange, may come into this show as well.
I thought maybe Black Sky was the enemy of the Golden Child. There seemed to be a thing going on there. No, just me.
Well, we made a desperate Dan crossover suggestion in the interview. Maybe.
Yes. Well, he did say he wasn't. He didn't know the comic books because he used to read Dandy and the Beano, and then we got bogged down in him that he'd been quoted as saying, what had he said?
He said British actor slams classic British,
comics. But he wanted to put on the record he was unslamming them because he loved them. So we thought maybe they could be a crossover possibility.
I'd love to see Sid Snake in the the MCU.
James.
Billy Whiz would work, wouldn't he? He'd be like Quicksilver.
Didn't see that coming.
He really would.
Speaking of Stick, what did you think of the childhood? Because each big character, Kingpin and Daredevil, get their flashback origin story. I really liked how they handled that. And Stick can be a little bit ridiculous, but it was actually okay. Mm. But the poor guy has dealt with some really brutal father figures. And I'm including Kingpin because he seems to be a kid. Like, Daredevil is a kid and yet is a grown-up at the same time. It's all...
Like Fisk, I guess.
Yeah, I suppose so.
Well, you know, here's an interesting question. I really liked the first two episodes with his dad, with Batlin Jack, and I quite liked the little flashbacks and whatnot. But how derelict is he as a dad? Really, when you look at it, when you really boil it down to nitty gritty, this is a man who chooses to die. Yes, it gives his son the means with which to pursue a career in law and whatnot, but he chooses to go out in a blaze of glory, which is fairly selfish, first of all, and also then to die so he will remove himself from his, what, 9-year-old son's life at that point? Who's just been blinded.
Just to play devil's advocate here.
Daredevil's advocate, Helen.
Daredevil's advocate here. Thank you.
Avocado, please.
Just to play daredevil's avocado here. I guess what he's trying to do there is, first of all, set a good example that he's not going to back away from the fight, that he's not going to throw the fight and be dishonest in
Murdoch's
that sense.
Always get up. They never stay down.
They always get up. They never stay down. And also, he just refuses point blank to throw the fight. He's going to take this one to the mattresses, if you will. Second of all, he obviously sets up that whole trust fund thing, but he does hope to get away with it. Like, he rushes to his locker after the fight. He's frantically trying.
I think
to,
he knows. He's seen Pulp Fiction.
He knows the risk. He knows the risk.
He knows the risk. He's not surprised when they catch up with him, for example. But also he knows he's about to load a whole ton of Catholic guilt on his kids that's going to play into his life later on. And Helen,
I'm
a Protestant. I don't know an awful lot about Catholic guilt. I know a lot about trying to stamp it out, obviously. Not the other. Tell us about that aspect of Max. Tell us about that aspect.
We'll
of
have
Max.
A special podcast for that one.
The thing, I mean, listen, here's the thing about Catholic guilt is you have it from basically birth.
You're given it in a bag.
It doesn't really matter. And it doesn't matter if you stay Catholic. You can give up the faith. Doesn't matter. You have it anyway. So he's not really adding any extra onto that burden. It's just there. That's just daredevil. It's going to happen. No big deal.
Okay. But the question, Ali, was about Stick, wasn't it? And I really like Scott Glenn as Stick. I thought he was fantastic.
I enjoyed their fight scene in his flat, which is a great flat.
Oh, God, it's so good.
But that fight scene in the flat's great. And I actually, you know, my favourite shot of the bit is with the two, I'm going to say nunchucks, and I know that's not the right word, but the two sticks when he's leaping through the air and is coming down on them. I love that. That's really good. And I wanted to see, by the end of it, 13 episodes in, you go, oh, yeah, he's wearing red. Yeah, he's meant to wear red. I remember. Yeah. And he's meant to have the sticks. Yeah, with strings. Yeah. I remember. But you're so involved with the show that by that point you go, oh, yeah, Daredevil, he looks like, you know, him off Princess Bride. That's fine. That's how I remember him.
They keep actually referring to him by the same name. It was very confusing for me.
Dread Pirate Roberts.
The
man in black and all this kind of stuff. Very, very confusing.
On a slightly different note, do you think there's a way of doing it without so much flashbackery?
Flashbackery?
Mm.
It did feel after a while like I'd seen quite a lot of the dad being battling.
There's a lot, because there's three or four threads that flashback, which is quite a lot for me. I'm not a massive flashback fan, especially in the sort of establishing establishing stuff. It doesn't do it badly at all, but you're just like, oh, crikey, we're doing that again, are we?
It starts with a flashback. It starts with, you know, his accident. And like, I thought it was okay, it's fine, but I'd rather have seen him as an adult and then maybe incorporate that somewhere down the line. But the dad stuff's done very quickly, is episode 2, and then he's gone.
Yeah. But then you go, you flash back to Stick's first arrival on the scene, don't you?
Yeah.
I wonder if you could introduce Stick without necessarily having to show that early stuff.
Maybe they only had Scott Glenn for one episode, so maybe that's.
Had to cram it all in.
Maybe these things dictate.
Potentially.
If you think this has a lot of flashbacks, the Green Arrow spin-off's got a lot of them.
Has it? I mean, not saying flashbacks are bad across the board.
But that was terrible. Terrible.
Did I just miss a terrible pun?
Yes, yeah.
Oh, no.
The Arrow spin-off is called Flash.
Oh, flashback.
And he has a back.
Yeah. He's got a back.
That happened.
Easy humour.
That was the thing that happened. One of the things that struck me about the show, and we talked about it a little bit, is the violence in the show, which is on a level that we have not seen in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, that's for sure. But it's rated 15 on Netflix. They do pull their punches with the language. There's about 6 shits an episode. By that, I mean people say the word shit 6 times. Not that Matt goes and
shitless.
He doesn't go to the toilet 6 times an episode. That would be interesting.
And boring. That would be really boring.
And I think someone says asshole and there's bastards, but they don't say the F word. They don't say the F word. And you kind of feel that they could. You always feel that they're on the cusp of it.
What, Fisk?
Oh yeah, anybody who says Fisk gets killed, so.
That's true.
I think
you
I heard
mother
a dickhead
in there? Is that possible?
You probably heard a dickhead.
Or a wanker?
I thought I heard a wanker.
A wanker?
No, wanker seems weird in
I
this world.
I think Foggy dropped in a couple of English expressions.
It did seem weird. Yeah, I remember thinking, English, yeah. That seems yeah. weird, saying okay. wanker.
He called someone a spiv and a knob jockey and a
bounder and a cad. You're a cad.
He said that Fisk was a twerp.
A twerp.
You're a gosh damn cad. You bounder.
Flip off, he said.
But the violence, yes.
The violence,
I mean,
yes.
I think the one that actually, I mean, the corridor fight was violent, but it doesn't have the sort of blood and gore up close. The one that really made me kind of gasp and slightly jump back in horror was the head on a spike.
Yep.
Oh my God.
There you go.
I'd blank that out. That was Game of Thrones.
Basically, that really was.
Here's what my wife, she's a massive fan of the Marvel movies, but I kept saying, oh, you should watch the show Daredevil. You know, it's really, really good. She's going, no, I don't want to. It doesn't feel like I want to watch it. I'm like, okay. So I started watching it on my own. And she came in from work. And I was about 10 minutes from the end of episode 3. And he was just about to fight that dude. And I went, come on, see, it's really good. Watch Daredevil with me. And she sits down with me. And they go, oh, this is actually pretty good. Oh, my God. Oh, I'm not watching this kind of thing. But then I made her go back and watch episode 1 and she loves it now. But that is an extraordinary scene.
Yes.
Yeah. He headbutts a spike.
Yes.
He does.
So there needs to be a name for that. It's like kebabbing or something.
Oh, God. Let's not have a name for it. I mean, let's not encourage it.
But you know something crazy is going to happen because that guy's nuts from the get-go when yeah. he arrives, isn't he?
But yeah. his thought process isn't great, is it?
No.
It's a bit like... Give me the name. Tell me the name.
Where
no,
is he?
I won't tell you the name. All right, I'll tell you the name, but I now have to kill myself. Whereas I could have just not told you the name and not had to kill myself. Whoops.
Yeah. And you just would have beaten me up or something. Yeah. I mean, like, yeah, there's not a huge amount of thought process there. And then obviously the car door scene. There are moments in this that are, yeah, really quite shocking. Mm. This is not the same world that we saw in, you know.
Yeah.
I don't know. The fight. Fluffier Marvels.
It certainly isn't. There's no, you know, it's like Coulson being spiked by Loki in certain countries now. The spike is removed.
Ooh.
And for Blu-ray releases. So over here, for example, whenever Loki, you don't see the spike go through Coulson's chest anymore. That's always fun.
How much blood is there in The Avengers?
It's not a lot of blood.
The blood is the thing that they always take out and that helps them get the lower rating. Yeah. So there's things that would, in real life, obviously cause enormous amounts of blood to be spilled,
yeah.
but in films, generally speaking, you can rely on there being very little.
The Winter Soldier, for example. If the Winter Soldier had blood in it, it yeah. would be an 18, but it doesn't. But this there's the fight between Matt and... I'm not calling him Daredevil until the very end. There's a fight between Matt and Nobu. That is unbelievable. He's being sliced and ripped and stabbed and skewered and kebabbed. And yeah, that's proper. You get to the point where you're kind of going, I don't think you'd be a live person anymore.
Mm. It's sore, isn't it?
Yeah.
It is ferocious.
It's all right, guys. He meditates and so he heals. It's fine. That's all explained. I can't believe you weren't paying attention
I'm
to
still
that.
Thinking about the Captain America Winter Soldier bit. Yeah. Well, if he had blood in that, yeah. the lift scene, if you put the camera down the corridor, opens the lift, he walks out a river of blood, like in The Shining. That would be amazing. But seriously, serious point, I'm not a bloodthirsty person but it's good to see the consequences of violence. It's not
yes.
necessarily fun to watch. And you do see people cause and effect in a way mm. that sometimes with the big movies you don't.
Yeah.
It's all a bit like bang, smash, kapow. Yeah. And this is not like that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I really like that. And it actually brings into play one of the best things about the show for me. And an element that I'm really sad was not in it more. Rosario Dawson as Claire. I loved her relationship with Matt. And it's not just because I fancy Rosario Dawson, Helen.
I wasn't going to say
I saw
say
you making
it,
a face. It's partially that, yes. But I thought she was really, really good. I thought their relationship was really nicely sketched out in just a couple of episodes. And honestly, there was one. She wasn't in a whole bunch of episodes. And then I think she's in episode 11 and her name comes up at the credits. And my wife and I both went, yes! She's back in it. And then, of course, she turns up for 5 minutes and leaves.
I feel like she might be the thread connecting these four shows.
I was hoping that, yeah.
Yeah, I feel like that would make sense if she's kind of everybody's go-to point for medical help. And it would be a nice kind of, first of all, a linking device, a linking person, but also she's such a good character. I'd like to see that developed in another way.
But it's also interesting because I thought at one point the show was going to veer away from the Matt-Karen Page relationship and have Matt and Claire be a thing. But it didn't seem to go in that way. And I thought it was actually setting up Foggy and Karen as a potential pairing. And then towards the end it kind of veered back and went, no, it's fairly clear that Karen fancies Matt all the way through.
Yeah. Well, I think she likes Foggy as well.
She likes Foggy. Yeah.
But I think that what's clear is that in the just announced season two, she'll mostly be dealing with her own demons and not so much making eyes at any either of her bosses.
Yes, that seems to be the case.
Seems to be the way it's going.
Yeah, I was reading up on a character. By God, she gets a bad go of it.
Yep.
Things that happen to her, like she get told she has HIV and she doesn't. I mean, that's bad. And then dead parents all over the shop and all kinds of badness. Mm. And she dies in the comic books at some point, so let's hope that doesn't happen.
Yeah, fingers crossed.
Yeah, I thought she was great. Deborah Ann Woll was fantastic in this.
Did you see, by the way, the Stiltman costume in the back of the, whatchamacallit, the contraption-making room, the Melvin, whatever that name of the guy
Melvin
is?
Melvin Potter.
Melvin Potter. In the back, you can see the Stiltman outfit with the extendable legs just in the background. And you can see, because he becomes a gladiator. For those who don't know, that's a slightly ridiculous, slightly cool character that says essentially has Robot War-style arms, the blades that spin round the wrists, and
ooh,
that goes up against his neck and all that kind of stuff.
Yes, it would
see
seem
sketches of that. On
yeah,
it would seem clear that Matt at some point does not keep Betsy safe, and then Mr. Potter goes.
Yeah, that was a slightly glib promise, I thought, on Matt's part a little bit.
Betsy, yes, don't worry, she's absolutely. Oh, she's dead.
Yeah, so he might be well advised to keep an eye on Betsy, poor Betsy.
He can't,
she is.
Helen. The whole premise of the show is that he can't see. Have you missed that?
I'm so sorry.
How did you miss that? That's astonishing to me. There's tons of other things we will just talk about very, very quickly. The show's depiction of journalism. How do we feel about that?
Idealised, perhaps?
Get to the metro section where there'll be loads of wonderful rewards, including great healthcare and a seat that's warm.
To be honest, actually, the show's depiction of journalism in some of its more cynical aspects is very true, I think. Nowadays, the pressure
nothing.
To... Yeah.
Saying nothing.
The pressure to you know, get hits or sell advertising or whatever over pure investigative journalism, as it used to be. Investigatory journalism, sorry, Zoolander. So yeah, I think there's some slightly depressing things to be said about the profession there, but they're not entirely unfair or inaccurate. And Ben Urich, that was a really good character, and I really liked that sort of that whole setup. I thought that was really interestingly played out. I like that he was, you know, one minute trusted by his boss and the next minute under pressure to drop it all and move on. It gave a ring of, I don't know, it gave a ring of realism, I guess, to the crusading journalist trope, I thought.
Mm.
And the wrinkle that the boss wasn't the one informing, it was the boss's secretary.
Yeah.
And also, can I just point out, when the guy does, Daredevil finally persuades a guy high up in the corrupted cop ranks to dob in Fisk and the rest of his cronies, it's that one witness that powers everything falling apart. So you can only presume in that montage, which has a very interesting track, I seem to remember going behind it, I can't remember off the top of my head, except my apologies, that it just seems to just tumble down. And I feel like Fisk needed to put in more safeguards for this kind of shit happening, and obviously he did, because he had a setup where if he ever gets chucked in the back of a police van, that 18 SWAT guys would appear out of nowhere and just rescue him. So, you know, he had the emergency call to pull.
Yeah, he did. He did some layers there of protection, I think it's fair to say.
Yeah, he really did. But he didn't. He didn't legislate for one thing.
Daredevil.
I was slightly disappointed in the way that I liked Ben Urich and I liked Fonda Curtis Hall in that role. But it does show that, hey, kid, don't cling to what happens in the comics. We're going into new uncharted territory here, and also bad journalists. they must all die. I just like the idea that people blogging in underpants can make more than us. But does anyone else share my feelings about the last episode? And that I felt it was slightly clumsy. I didn't think the hero shots felt cheap to me. And it felt to me that towards the end that the show's ambition outweighed its budget. There was a bit, I really liked the idea of Matt running across town trying to find Madame Gao's heroin factory, but it led to the show's really first egregious example of stuntman in terrible wig. I mean, if you look at that shot where he's running along the rooftops, and it's clearly not Charlie Cox. It's just some guy that they've scraped up some shavings of a barber's floor, glued it to someone's head, and had him parkour himself around a roof in New York. And then the next shot is a bit like View to a Kill.
Yeah.
Roger Moore stops in close up, and then it's a 25-year-old
elderly woman.
Next shot. And then I just felt the costume didn't work for me. It didn't, and you know, the fact that the press suddenly call him Daredevil, all that stuff felt rushed, and it needed to have a little bit more time to breathe. Ironically, on a show we just said might be, you know, could do with 10 minutes less each episode. But does anyone else feel this way, or am I alone?
No, I do. Hmm. I do. It didn't feel quite like the same show that I'd watched for the rest. I didn't expect a bit where the three of them would be looking at the front page of the newspaper and going, Daredevil, I like that name. I just didn't see the show being that show. Yeah. But I forgive it. You forgive it. Like, for many reasons we've explained earlier.
Yeah. I think it did feel a little bit quick, I guess, to go from, you know, universally despised to universally adored. But at the same time, you needed some kind of flip to give, I guess, some kind of resolution at the end, to give him hope at the end. And they did spend a good two, three episodes kind of taking down the Kingpin and having his sort of counter-Kingpin mission or counter-Fisk mission come to some kind of, you know, culmination. So I guess, you know, within the story, it maybe worked. I think when you step outside and take a little bit of a further look at it, then, yeah, it falls apart.
If you're going to compare it to The Wire, which has been done, there wasn't a Stringer Bell moment, or an Yvonne Barksdale moment, for that matter.
In what way?
Well, there wasn't that kind of that moment where of resolution, where you think, oh, this has all come together really nicely in one particular set piece or one particular episode. It kind of felt like towards the end it was setting up for something else a bit, which obviously it is. Mm. But yeah, I would agree with you. I didn't think the final episode was perhaps as good as it could have been.
Mm.
And it started so strongly, and I don't think it quite delivered. I mean, the fight scene in episode two was the best in the show, I think, for me. And could have just maybe done with something like that at the end, potentially. But
I did like their fight at the end. I think it's a shorter one, but I did really buy it. I thought it was good to see the two of them face off mano a mano, I guess. An element that didn't really pay off for me the way I thought it might was Madame Gao's blind workers. I thought there'd be a little bit more of a, I don't know, more of a connection or more of a link there between them and Daredevil.
There's a really clumsy cut in the penultimate episode when Matt goes to that factory and Madame Gao goes, alerts her workers to the fact that he's in their midst, and they start mobbing him and attacking him.
And he just crawls out.
Yeah, he's going, oh, no, I'm okay. And then the next time we see him, he's on top of a crate leaping at people. And it's like, so how did he escape the mob of people? Because that would be tricky, even for him, that would be tricky to escape. But, you know, I really like where the show is going, and I like that it has potential. And, you know, its depiction of Matt's abilities are fine so far. You know, in the comics, Daredevil's really bouncy and agile. He's almost Spider-Man-like in his ability to bounce around a room and avoid stuff. And this show just about sold that he could move faster than gunfire, because he can anticipate where it's going to be and he can move around it. And I like that. I want to see more of that as it moves on.
Mm.
For sure.
Foshes.
I'm very excited about season two. I want to see more. I was actually a little bit depressed when I finished the series, because I thought, well, I'm still looking forward to seeing, you know, Iron Fist and Luke Cage and aka Jessica Jones, but I want more Daredevil. So I'm glad that they're not holding everything back for the Defenders. I'm looking forward to those as well. I'm sure they'll be good, and I'm sure that they'll, you know, wipe this whole series from my head and go, no, this one is the best one. Whichever one I've watched most recently, that's the best one. But at the same time, it's good to know that there'll be more coming.
And you must also be thinking, oh, Daredevil's over. Where's my Marvel fix coming from?
Where can I possibly get a Marvel fix this week? Oh, no.
Never going to happen.
No.
But guys, you excited about season two? You think it's going to be?
Yeah. I don't know whether this is a hot scoop, but I certainly found it interesting that he told us that the second season will come out before Defenders will.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, which...
That is interesting, definitely. And
which has such great confidence in that they can fit in yet more Daredevil before they... Maybe there'll be some aspects of the other characters not within the Defenders, but they'd introduce maybe Iron Fist would make most sense for me.
Yeah, it doesn't sound like we're going to have too long to wait either, which is good, because I'm looking forward to seeing more of it.
Fantastic.
Bring it on. Let's do this, Netflix. Get going. Don't rest on your laurels. Make another one right now.
Are you surprised? Because they didn't announce a second season, and I think that's good, you know, until Matt Murdock shoved a cheese in Tony Ayres' face and, give me a second series, you shit. but, you know, they didn't announce a second season. They announced the Defenders. They had that confidence to do so. I was surprised. I thought they were just going to go one Daredevil, one Jessica Jones, one Luke Cage, one Iron Fist.
Me too.
Defenders. But now Daredevil seems to be very much set up as the Iron Man of this group, like the first one, the most important one. And we're going to get a second season of that before we get Defenders, the way we got two Iron Man movies before Avengers.
Which I guess would affect the way that they weave the other shows together.
Yeah.
Because there'd be a gap point. I mean,
is Charlie going to, is he going to show up in the other ones? Is he going to show up in Jessica Jones? And...
Well, we don't know that, but I mean, that's going to be complicated. If he's got a second season of his own and then they've got the Defenders, how are they going to work that arc? But I'm not sure. And you know, what happens if Jessica Jones does really well? Are they making a second season of that before Defenders? Maybe they just keep pushing Defenders back forever.
It'll just never
constantly
happen.
Who knows?
Amazing, amazing. Well, yeah, lots to talk about. It's a 13-episode season, but we hope we've covered most of the main stuff.
Can we ask our listeners to tweet in with news of any of those sort of obscure swear words that we may or may not have heard?
Or indeed the Easter eggs that we may have missed
as well.
Oh, yeah,
the Easter eggs too.
Because there's absolutely tons in there as well. But yeah, bring on Daredevil Season 2. And that is it for this spoiler special edition of the Empire Podcast. Our next one is for Avengers Age of Ultron, featuring Joss Whedon and a little bit, soupçon, if you will, of Paul Bettany. So do check that one out. It should be up Monday, May 4th. May go a little earlier. We'll see. We're waiting for the US release. We want to give people in the States a chance to watch the film and catch up with it before we unleash spoiler hell. But yeah, thanks for listening to this one. Listen to the next one as well. And it's goodbye from Ali.
Goodbye.
It's goodbye from Phil.
Goodbye.
It's goodbye from Helen.
Toodaloo.
And it's goodbye from me. Thanks for listening. See you next time. Bye. We'll